Welcome to the ClearVid MBA Admissions Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Georgetown McDonough's MBA program. Today, I'm joined by Alex Brown, my colleague here at ClearAdmit, although he is not here at ClearAdmit. I am in Philadelphia. And Alex, where in the world are you today?
I'm in Cornwall, the southwest tip of the UK, where I now live, and enjoying some sunny weather, which is kind of a nice break from the gales that we've had for the last week.
Well, you guys get, at least an hour of daylight during this time of the year, right?
Yeah, it does seem like that some days, but quite honestly, other days, certainly in the summer, it's absolutely stunning. But yeah, right now, it's not too bad.
So today we are going to talk about round two and applying to business school in that second round, which, as many of our listeners know, is comprised of, you know, the sort of January deadlines that schools have. And we want to give our listeners a roadmap to round two success. And so we've come up with sort of 8 key areas or tips that folks can use as they travel through the round two process. And Alex, I'm just thrilled that you're able to join us today and share some of that expertise that you have. And I'll chip in where I can as well. And we'll kind of go through and give people all the advice they might need for success in the second round.
Sure, I'm excited to do this. And I'm grateful for the opportunity because, as you know, and like yourself, this is stuff I'm passionate about.
So Alex, the first thing that I wanted to talk about is I think it's important for a candidate going into the second round to know what kind of round two candidate they are. Do you want to share some thoughts on that?
Sure. Basically, I think that in a very broad sense, there are two types of candidates that are going to be applying in round two. Those that did apply in round one and those that haven't applied yet at all. So those that did apply in round one, again, fall into 3 buckets. They may not have been as successful as they'd hoped, so they're sort of rejigging their application strategy and maybe aiming a little bit lower in terms of the competitiveness of the schools that they're applying. And then on the other hand, it might be a candidate that's been very successful in round one and feels that she should apply potentially to some more schools of a little bit more sort of notoriety. And then the third bucket in this category are those that thought strategically at the beginning of the application process to apply to some schools in round one and some schools in round two. So those are the candidates that have already applied in round one. And then you've also got a candidates that are fresh to the process. And so they haven't yet applied during the season and coming to it fresh in the second round. So I think that kind of summarizes it. You could argue that some reapplicants that haven't applied in round one are coming into the process into round two and they reapplying from previous seasons. That said, I think most reapplicants do recognize that round one is a good sort of entry point into this.
Right. Yeah, and I would say one of the key differences between these different buckets, so the folks have already applied in the past versus those for whom this is going to be their first shot, is there's a difference in the learning curve, right? So whether you struck out in round one or got some acceptances, at minimum, you've been through the process and you have a sense of how it works. Whereas if this is your first go round, there's going to be a steeper learning curve. So I would suggest that, you know, for those applying for the first time in round two, leave a little extra time because it's not, you know, you're not going to know the journey as some of your peers might.
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely correct about this learning curve issue. And the reality is your first applications aren't generally going to be your best applications. So those candidates that have applied in round one and are now targeting round two do absolutely benefit from this issue, as you suggest.
Right. So I think that's our first tip, sort of know which kind of round two candidate you are, because it'll determine how much time you need as well as school selection. And, you know, obviously, I know that for some of our listeners who may be aimed very high in round one, only to kind of be rejected without interview, or perhaps you're listening to this in a few weeks and you found out you didn't get in even after an interview. I know it can be kind of demoralizing, but this is an opportunity, as you say, to kind of produce a really high caliber application because you're going through this kind of a second time and you have had a lot of learning in the first phase. So let's move on to our second tip, and that is a tip around deadline timing. I think it is absolutely critical to look at the calendar. And do you want to elaborate on that, Alex?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Graham. Typically, the most condensed period for the application season is the first week after the traditional holiday season in the US, you know, the Christmas, New Year break. The following week to that break, many of the top schools have their round two application deadline. So I can run off a few very quickly. January 3rd is Wharton. January 4th is Harvard. Chicago Booth is also January 3rd. So is Duke. Stanford is the 10th. But you get the idea that these top schools are basically coming back to work directly after the holidays. Many of them have taken a week's break. And there's a load of applications waiting for them. And what it means for the candidate, I think, is that they really need to think strategically about, you know, this sort of timing issue so that they can get their applications as good as they can be at least a day in front of each of these deadlines.
You already know you're capable of greatness, but wondering just how much you can achieve isn't enough. To truly have an impact on the world, you have to go find out exactly what you're made of. It's what sets the doers apart from the merely curious. With a curriculum designed to prepare you for the global stage, plus access to all Washington, D.C. has to offer, Georgetown's McDonough School of Business is the perfect launchpad for your career. Get started at choosegeorgetown.com/MBA. I will say that as a former admissions officer and as a former MBA applicant, I really scratched my head about, you know, when I was applying, I was really found it to be sort of cruel and unusual that, you know, all these deadlines are kind of stacked right after the holidays because you're seeking to, you know, spend time with family or do whatever. And then bam, you know, they all hit essentially at the same time. With that said, when I jumped to the other side and worked in admissions, obviously, you know, coming back to work from the holidays, I wanted a stack of applications on my desk or, you know, in the system to start reviewing right away because I wanted to get down to business. And so I understand why the schools do it that way, but it really can create a bit of a traffic jam if you're the applicant trying to figure out where to apply and, you know, which applications to get done when. And I will say that more than one candidate I've known has sort of neglected to take into account the subtle differences in the timing. So there are some schools that camp out the week after in kind of heading towards mid-January. And it would be really foolish to sort of spend all your time on those applications first when you've got like three deadlines in that first week. So make sure you're paying careful attention to the deadlines. That's really our second tip, I would say. Anything else on that one, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with your assessment. I mean, obviously, this calendar is focused around convenience for the schools, not for the candidates, which is a shame for those of you preparing those applications. But again, you know, you've got Chicago Booth and Wharton both on January 3rd, and a lot of people apply to both of those schools. So if you're one of those candidates, you need to be very strategic about being prepared. If you've got, let's say, Wharton and Darden on your radar, then you've got a week's break between the two schools. So it's kind of looking at if that can provide you some flexibility.
Yeah, great point. I think it's challenging. I also would add that there are candidates for whom they sort of look at the calendar and say, okay, so I'll just write these things over the Christmas holiday. And my advice, here we are in, you know, kind of November, I would say, you actually want to be writing and doing a lot of work on your Thanksgiving break so that you then have lots of time over the course of December to get these things lined up. And we'll get into maybe why that is as we move forward here, because there are other parts to your application that you're going to need to corral. So our third tip is really about the GMAT and the GRE. What are your thoughts there? I mean, some people, you know, candidates are going to be in different positions vis-a-vis these tests before they get to round two.
Yeah. I hate this aspect of the application. I know it's not the favorite of many of the candidates because, you know, these standardized tests, they're kind of a bit nerve-wracking. You've got to do a lot of preparation and so on and so forth. And people truly believe that the high GMAT score gets them into the top school and a low GMAT score eliminates them from any chance. Whereas there's lots of other aspects of your candidacy that are truly valuable and important. The reality is, I think, that all said, you really do need to present your best test score. And that sounds a little trite. Obviously, you want to present your best test score. But as a result of a lot of preparation for the test, so you don't want to take this piece of the application process lightly by any means. And you need to do this because your peers are doing this. So those that are applying with you that have similar work experiences, similar goals, similar outside of activities, similar successes, are also preparing very hard for this standardized test. So if you don't, you're going to be leave yourself exposed. And I don't know the exact data, but quite a few candidates, and we're talking maybe 50%, but plus or minus there, retake these tests or take these tests more than once if they're not satisfied with their scores. So I would try to look at the schools you're applying, look at their average score of the entering class, and really use that as a goal for what you want to accomplish. And you know, the schools are now being more open, I guess is the right term, to the GRE test. But again, recognizing that you still have to do as well as you possibly can in the GRE, just like the GMAT, to prepare yourself. So I think I covered that. I don't know, Graham, you have more thoughts on the sort of standardized test aspect of the application.
I mean, I think that's terrific. The only thing I would add is if you are a round one candidate who sort of struck out in the first round, and part of your sort of gearing up for round two involves taking a hard look at what may have gone wrong, and if that hard look reveals that you need to retake, I just want to make sure that people are planning for that and not just assuming, okay, well, I'll take the GMAT in mid-December and then I'll kind of look to my applications afterwards. You're going to need to parallel process if you're someone who's taking the test or has yet to take it or needs to retake it, right? So you have to get going on the applications because, again, as we mentioned in tip number two about deadline planning, things are really stacked together and you can't really afford to sort of just waltz on in and get it done at the last minute. So I think that's the main thing I would add is just, yeah, keep an eye on the calendar and don't assume that you can just pour all of your efforts into the GMAT and then worry about everything else when the deadlines are just a couple weeks away.
Yeah, I think that's an extremely important point. And, you know, again, those of you that did apply in round one and are sort of a little bit disappointed with your results so far, you really do have to take a hard look at every aspect of the application. And your applications in round two will be stronger. Just through, again, the learning curve that Graham addressed earlier in the podcast. But that said, you have an opportunity to potentially make a big impact on increasing the quality of your overall candidacy by improving your standardized test. That's a lot easier to do, even though it's very difficult, but it's a lot easier to do than sort of changing your work experience in the course of 2 or 3 months or an additional activity outside of work or something like that. So this is one element of an application that you can control for to some extent to make an improvement quickly.
Right. And I know that the folks who make the GRE and the GMAT exam talk about them as being aptitude tests where, you know, it's hard to move the meter in any one direction by more than 20 or 30 points. But I mean, I'm kind of living proof. I applied to business school with a fairly low score and retook the test and added over 100 points to my score. So I think people should know that you can move the meter. And as you say, it's not easy, but it's something to look into because you could really change the character of your application.
And I'm sure, Graham, that was all about preparation for the test. So whilst GMAT and GRE folks say it's hard to improve your ability and in terms of performance in the test, it isn't hard to improve your preparation to increase your performance.
Yeah, I took it cold the first time and then I spent a lot of time prepping to take it the second time and that made the difference.
And you can imagine now, Graham, I mean, because you're really old at this point, sorry, but you can imagine now all the prep materials that are available to these candidates, right, in this era versus when we were directly involved in this process.
Right. And I just want to state for our listeners that, you know, Alex is actually much older than me. So, you know, we're going to. Okay. So, our fourth tip is about letters of recommendation. This is one that I think there's a unique challenge in round two because of the holidays. So, Alex, do you want to just talk a little bit about how people can prepare their recommenders?
Sure. And obviously, you can add more insight directly as someone that has prepared their recommenders. But I would say that if you haven't, I mean, obviously, you need to get your recommenders identified in short order if you haven't already done that. And you want people that obviously that like you, you know, as a human being, but also that can really say strong things about you from a professional standpoint. So knowing the types of questions that are being asked in the recommendation forms and knowing that these people that you select can answer the questions, not just say you're a wonderful person, but then back it up with substance and anecdotes and so on and so forth. So selection is very important. I would also, you know, suggest that you prepare some materials for your recommenders, whether it's your updated resume. Make sure your recommenders absolutely know your goals, your post-MBA goals, and why you're pursuing this route, because you want them to be true cheerleaders of this process for you, as well as maybe if you've already drafted some of the essays for the schools to sort of show the recommenders sort of, you know, some of the material. So the more you can prepare your recommenders, fantastic. Don't write these recommendations. That's not only unethical, but I think it's unhelpful for you, because you want a different voice in your application at this point from your recommenders. And then finally, all I would say is not only prepare them well, but keep in touch and make sure that they've really tackled this process, in your case, hopefully before the holidays really set into gear, the sort of, you know, mid-December to New Year timeframe, because then things can really slow down. So lots of preparation, and then lots of engagement through the process, so that they're really ready and able to deliver, and they're truly cheerleaders for you in this process.
Yeah, I think many an applicant has run into trouble when it comes to, you know, leaving this a bit to the last minute and then expecting their recommenders to write and submit letters during Christmas and New Year's, when, you know, the recommenders have other things to do and you know, they don't have the same kind of order of priorities as you might when it comes to this application process. So yeah, get them going. If you haven't selected them, get on that, and then get them the materials, as you mentioned, Alex, and just stay on them. One thing I will say, we're sympathetic to the plight of both the recommender and the applicant. And so we try to do a lot of things on our website to make it easier, right? So we have all the recommendation questions posted for each school, which, believe it or not, the schools themselves don't make it easy for the candidates to access. You know, obviously, once you put your recommenders into the online application system for a school, they get an email and they can log in and fill out the form, but you don't see the form. And so we've tried to make that easier so that you can get a sense as to where the overlap lies, because I think one of the things that I always recommend people to do when dealing with the referees is to send them a list of kind of, these are the 10 questions you will need to answer in order to produce all the content that's needed. So kind of finding the overlap and making it easier for them by reviewing the questions and saying, oh, you know, if you answer this question for Stanford, you've already done it for HBS or whichever school it may be. And the schools have come increasingly in line in terms of sharing the same recommender questions, although it's not exact yet. So there are differences from school to school. And yeah, so just making sure your recommenders are prepared is pretty vital, and making it easy for them.
Yeah, and Graham, maybe you have a point of view on this too, but I would also caution anybody that says to their recommenders, really, you can answer these questions in a general sense. And I know at least one or two schools have actually come out and said, it's fine, actually, if you give us a general letter of recommendation and don't directly answer our questions. And I would caution people going down that route, because I do think it really signals to the school that they are not a priority. They're not their number one choice. So if a school says you can do that, just, you know, still endeavor to answer directly the questions they ask, because those questions are important to them.
Exactly. And I'm going to pull back the veil on something that's, I think, only in our strategy guide to recommendation letters, which you can download on our website. And that is that we often say that, you know, in addition to sharing your goals and your resume and your, you know, some other materials with your recommenders, it's pretty important that your recommenders know what it is that you are passionate about within each school you're applying to. So like, why are you so excited to go to Haas or Tuck or whatever school it is? Because they can sort of echo that in their letter and even, you know, have a line in the letter or something to the effect of, you know, I've spoken with Alex extensively about his interest in your program, and he is just incredibly excited about A, B, and C. And so there can be a chance for them to kind of demonstrate that not only are they close to you and playing an active role, but that they're aware of your interest in the school. And that obviously makes the school feel good, like they are a priority. So that's just one tidbit. I do recommend people check out the recommender guide, because I think there's a lot of great advice in there, and we can't possibly delve into all of it in a short podcast here.
Yeah, very important.
So let's move forward to the fifth tip here for success in round two, and that's around essay writing. Any advice that you have on this? Again, I think timing is important, but what are your thoughts here?
Obviously, timing's important. You're going to ultimately write a lot of drafts of these essays, and those of you that applied in round one will readily recognize this. And, you know, obviously some of the schools, most schools have some kind of goals type essay, you know, the nuanced essays, it's very important to know, you know, the issues you've got to address. But what I would suggest is taking a step backwards before you write essays and sort of come up with a document that highlights sort of kind of like a personal inventory. So it sort of suggests what are your best anecdotes to highlight certain aspects of your candidacy, like your leadership, your teamwork, your sort of empathy, your emotional intelligence, and so on and so forth. Because these are issues that schools are really trying to understand through the medium of the essays. So drafting a sort of an extensive document in that regard. So you cover all bases and then figure out what anecdotes and what examples you would then draw from for each of the essays that you're going to write, and then start drafting your essays. So that's the process that I kind of outlined in the book that we wrote for MBA admissions, sort of Clear Admit, the Comprehensive Guide to Admissions, whatever the title is. But the book's freely available too, so it's only like 60 or 70 page read, so it'd be a good resource. But take a step back, identify all your anecdotes and your qualities and so forth, and then look at starting to draft those essays.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I typically tell people that, you know, Thanksgiving in the U.S., at least for American applicants, is a good little break during which you can start brainstorming and actually drafting some of these. And I think for those candidates who don't get time off for Thanksgiving, I mean, just getting going, you know, in late November with drafts is important, because more than one candidate in my experience, like sort of whether at Wharton or in Clear Admit, used to individually advise candidates, you know, I've seen so many candidates leave this for, I'm going to have a week off between Christmas and New Year's. I'll just bang them all out, you know, over that time frame. And I think it's really challenging to do that.
I think there are other aspects of the essay process that's important is to get feedback as you're going through this process, because ultimately you are going to make, you know, three or four runs at this in terms of drafts and updating and fine tuning, and the result of that, you get others to provide you feedback on you know what these essays are telling them about you and making sure that you're hitting the right mark. So I think feedback, Graham, is a very important part of this process. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think you need to fold in some time right for that, because and one other thing I will say, this happens a lot in round two because of the holiday season and because applicants are often spending time with family, is they give their essays to mom and dad, or, you know, their brother or sister, whoever, to read, or an uncle. And I think, you know, your family is inherently going to be biased and kind of think that everything you say is great. And so I would recommend that you get feedback, and you can have family read it, but I would try to find someone else who, you know, a colleague from work or somebody who's more objective to, you know, to kind of read over and give you that feedback. So yeah, really vital.
Very good. And the other thing I would suggest is if you can build into your time frame, so really having a time frame mapped out for this process, try to build in 2 or 3 days where once you've finished your essays, you can just leave them and then go back for one sort of look again. Because editing your own essays and reading them and adding them, and it just becomes then more and more difficult. So if you can have a bit of a break and a bit of a gap, that then helps you sort of for those final tweaks. And lastly, from an editing standpoint, someone told me one time, and as part of my own writing, the best thing that you can do is read those essays to yourself out loud, slowly. And that really helps you pick up any sort of little bits of typos and various other things that, whilst probably not catastrophic, if your whole application is riddled with typos, that's just clearly shoddy and not good. So you want to eliminate the typos to the extent that you can.
Yeah, I would say that even those schools typically go on the record as saying, look, we're not penalizing you for a typo. It's about the content. And, you know, obviously typos where you mention the wrong school can be pretty bad. But I think generally they try to say they're accepting. But I personally know, and maybe this is my liberal arts background or something, but when I read materials that have typos or grammatical errors, I can't help but feel differently about the author. And I think that given that the profile of many of the readers on these admissions committees is more of a kind of maybe liberal arts or, you know, they're not business people. I think that you have to be careful and that having well-edited materials is important. I think another thing that I'm hearing as we go through all these different tips is there is this underlying message from us about getting going early and leaving time, like as you say, leaving time to step away from the materials and come back to them. So it's all about time. And I think, you know, I would argue that yeah, folks really need to get started as soon as possible. Of course, once they finish listening to this episode. But yeah, getting going early is important. Let's turn to our sixth sort of area that we're going to discuss. Our tip number six is about data forms. And I think, yeah, candidates fall into a number of different traps with the data forms. Do you want to speak to that, Alex?
Sure. If you've identified the schools you're applying in round two and you're already perhaps drafting up some essays and dealing with your recommenders process and so forth, that's fantastic. Many of you will look at the data forms as something to do at the last minute as you're about ready to submit the application. And then that, to me, is a significant error of judgment. And I say this because what you have to think about from an application review standpoint is your essays and other elements of your application will be evaluated within the context of the data forms and the data that's provided through those data forms. So it behooves you before you write the essays and other aspects of the application to know what you've already needed to have addressed in the data forms. So I would suggest kick on with those data forms right now if you haven't done so already. And, you know, on top of that issue, schools seem to have moved some of the sort of essay-type questions directly into the data forms over the course of the last few years. So, again, that makes those data forms extra important, I think.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating how, you know, over the last, let's say, 5 to 7 years, there's been a gradual reduction in the number of, quote, essays that schools require. I mean, just as a great example, HBS used to have essentially 6 essays. I mean, really 4, but one of them was like a 3-parter. So they had a ton of essays. They now only have 1 and it's completely open-ended. But what's happened in the process is these schools have whittled down the requirements on the essays front. They've sort of snuck in a few short answer kind of type questions into the data forms. And the data forms used to really be just about you know, what's your GMAT score? How many times have you taken it? Where did you go to college? What's your GPA and major? List out your activities, list out your work experience, dates, salary, all that kind of stuff. So it was very kind of rote, just information you were providing. But now you have a little more qualitative stuff happening there. And I think it's also important to mention that you have to fill out these forms and they're different from school to school. So not every school is going to ask you to list your outside activities in the same way. Some might say, well, we want first your college activities, then we want your kind of current activities, and oh, here's another category which is just for hobbies or something. So it's just, and they all have different, you know, just ways of doing it. Some allow you to upload a resume when it comes to your work experience, and others will require you to use their format with, you know, dates, salary, title, overarching responsibilities followed by, you know, specific accomplishments. So it's different and it takes time. And like the essays, you don't want this to be sloppy. And I've seen many a candidate come in with wonderful essays and glowing letters of recommendation and then a really sloppy kind of data form. And you kind of can't help but wonder, gee, is this the same person? Like, you know, who wrote these essays and who did the data form? And, you know, so you have to be really careful. You want to have the same level of attention to detail across the application. So don't leave the data forms, get them set up and get them going.
Yeah, and I think data forms similar to the essays, similar to the recommendation questions, read every question very carefully. and make sure you're addressing every aspect of each of these questions as they're being asked. And that might sound obvious, but again, schools tend to ask questions in a slightly nuanced way for their own process. So just make sure that you complete the answers in the way exactly as they're being asked.
Yeah, I remember when we were working in admissions at Wharton, I remember sometimes feeling like, wow, if this person can't follow the instruction and give me the answer to the question that we've posed in the application, how are they going to follow directions when they get to business school or when they're working later, right? So there is this kind of basic thing of like following directions, which sounds silly and kind of fifth grade, but it is important. So yeah, pay close attention to that. And you know, the thing that can happen is, I mean, I often used to see, you know, schools ask for the information in different ways. And as an admissions officer, you know that. You're aware of how your chief competitor asks the question. And when you see candidates giving you data that is clearly copied and pasted from that other school's format, doesn't feel good, right? It doesn't feel like the candidate's interested in you. So that was our sixth area. Tip number seven is about interviewing. This is pretty brief, I think, given that many schools interview after. But is there anything you want to say about interviews and how a round two candidate can make sure that they're sort of on top of that piece of this puzzle?
Sure. A couple of things. If a school is offering open interviews for all candidates, and Tuck is probably the best example of this, then you absolutely want to try to do what you can to take one of those open interviews. Rather than wait and have your application reviewed and seeing if you're invited for an interview. So if the school offers an open interview, absolutely take that. I would also say, if you're applying to Kellogg, and just looking at my notes, Kellogg's deadline is January the 9th. I think there is an advantage of applying earlier than the deadline in Kellogg's case so that you can select the interview option that you desire. Because as those interview options fill up based on your geography, you run the risk of getting an interview waiver, which is not a particularly good scenario. Excuse me. So that's what I would suggest on the interview front at this point, Graham.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting that, you know, for schools that interview by invitation only after they've read your file, as tempting as it may be to kind of browse the Clear Admit interview archive and start looking at what questions they ask, I think you just back burner that until you get your applications in. Keep in mind, you'll have a lot of time once you've applied to start worrying about the interview and if you want to be optimistic and even start preparing for it. While you're waiting a potential invitation, then you can do so then. So I think unless it's a school that has open interviews, like you're saying, or in the case of like a Kellogg, you know, you don't really need to worry about this yet. It just, know your schools and know their, you know, their process, because there are some schools, as we say, that allow you to interview prior. I do think this dovetails nicely with our eighth and final tip in this podcast for round two success. And that is, you know, sometimes when you're interviewing at, say, Tuck, it's open interview, you go to campus. That's really the only way to do it at Tuck, right? So that dovetails into this eighth tip, which is about campus visits. And I think there's some nice differences between round one candidates doing campus visits versus round two. Did you want to speak to that?
Sure. If you're applying in round two, frankly, you have a great opportunity to visit campus, over the course of the next month. Before schools break for their holidays, and really experience the programs firsthand through whatever visit program is set up for the schools you're interested in, and absolutely would recommend you do that if you can do that. You have the resources and the wherewithal and the geography to do that. It really will strengthen the quality of your application from that firsthand experience, I think. And also sends a positive signal to the admissions committee of your commitment to the school if you have visited before you apply. So to the extent that you can do that, really take advantage of it, because those folks that applied in round one were sort of between a rock and a hard place in terms of visiting, because most campus visit programs don't actually begin until the round one deadlines are sort of imminent, as it were. But round two, folks, you have a much better opportunity to visit these schools. And they, like I say, the signal value is also very positive if you do that.
I think this is one of those benefits to kind of waiting in a sense, right? Because if you're applying in round two, you know, many people will say, oh, you missed the boat, you should have applied in the first round. But, you know, there are some benefits along the way, such as the ability to go to a campus in November and see everything in action. I would also say, and we could almost do an entire podcast on, you know, how to get the most out of, you know, a visitor. What's the checklist that you need to have in place in terms of, you know, catching up with students and club leaders and even faculty and visiting a class. So you can get a lot out of a campus visit that can really enrich the content in your essays and other materials so that you can, yeah, really make a compelling case to the admissions committee. So, yeah, to the extent that you're able, and I recognize a lot of our listeners are you know, not located near the schools they're applying to, but to the extent that you're able, carving out a little bit of time to visit the schools can actually improve your admissions odds in a number of ways. So go if you can, and, you know, take that advantage of being a round two candidate and put it to use.
And I would say on top of that, Graham, because you make some very good points there, but if you're visiting, take notes about how you feel as a result of the visit, what you did, and so on and so forth, because that will become sort of pretty interesting potential content either for your essays, but also later on in the process for your interviews, quite possibly. And also, if you meet people during the visit, which hopefully you do, and you sort of build up a bit of a rapport, try to get some contact information and follow up and try to build some kind of network with the schools that you're applying, because having advocates in the process is a fantastic advantage. And you're able potentially to do that if you visit and so forth. And what that means is potentially before you visit, do as much research as you can on the web and so forth, so you really make the most of that visit and you sort of engage and interact with the people that are potentially pursuing similar career paths as yourself, and have the same sort of academic goals and so on and so forth. So prep beforehand, take notes, try to get contact information of people you engage with, and that's really going to help you make the most of that visit, I think.
Yeah, agreed. And I just will share one kind of small anecdote. Imagine a scenario where, you know, you make the time to go out and visit, I'll just pick a school, let's say Stanford, since they just ranked number one in the Business Week ranking. So you go to Palo Alto, you visit the school, you put together a terrific application, and you make the interview cut. So they actually invite you for an interview. And as some of our listeners already know, Stanford does interviews using their alumni across the globe. So you don't go to campus to interview, you meet with an alumni in your market, with an alum, excuse me. So imagine the benefit of being able to sit down with that person who's been to the school and mention that you as well have gone and visited. And, you know, I can just picture a conversation around, oh, what's, you know, I haven't been back in a few years, says the alum. And you can say, oh, I was there a few months ago, and wow, the new facilities are stunning, or this is happening, or, you know, just this ability to kind of connect and show not only that you've taken the step to get there and are interested in the school, but just to kind of relate to the person that's interviewing you, because there are a number of schools, whether it's Columbia or Stanford, you know, who use alumni in their interview process. And so just another way to connect with your interviewer. And you could even say the same of an admissions committee member doing interviews in a hub. You know, you might go to London to interview for Harvard Business School, and to be able to say that you've been to campus and, you know, just sort of share that experience can count for something in terms of building rapport and demonstrating, you know, your passion to be a part of that community. So that is our eighth and final tip for success in round two. Just to kind of go back and sort of review, we talked about the importance of knowing what kind of a candidate you are in round two. Is this your first time through, or have you already applied, and that learning curve? We talked about paying careful attention to deadlines because they're all stacked on top of one another. We talked about getting the GMAT or the GRE out of the way and, you know, making sure there's time for that. We talked about managing your recommenders and navigating the holiday season, because they're not going to be as motivated perhaps to write a letter as opposed to having Christmas dinner or something. So not leaving that for the last minute. And then we went through a number of tips around how to be best prepared for the essays and when that writing should happen, getting feedback, et cetera. Not leaving the data forms for the last minute was our sixth tip. And then we talked about interviewing and campus visits. So I feel like we've given people a really nice roadmap here. Alex, I really appreciate your insights. You know, you didn't spend 7 years as a senior associate director of admissions at Wharton for nothing. So hopefully our candidates are benefiting from that expertise. And we really appreciate everyone tuning in. I will say that if you have a moment, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and please rate us, leave reviews. That's what makes this podcast possible. And Alex and I would love to continue to share our insights and talk about all things MBA admissions. So thanks so much, Alex, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Graham, and looking forward to doing this again.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you.
Take care.